If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
Okay, hello and happy RFRX Monday, everybody. Welcome back to another episode. I'm your host, Kara Griffin, and I have here with me a very special co-host this week, Gail Jordan. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm so excited about this new task. I don't know what to do.
That's all right. None of us do. Don't worry about it. We'll make it work. You're a bit of an expert on our program here, I think, as our executive director, so I think it'll be just fine. But how's your holiday weekend been, Gail?
Outstanding. Labor Day comes and goes, and it's sort of the transition to the end of summer going into the fall season. So it's bittersweet. You hate to see the summer end, but boy, that cooler weather looks good for many of us who are out in the sunshine.
Yes. Oh, I cannot wait. I love fall. We don't have too much of fall where I normally live in Texas, but you know what? We'll take what we can
take. We'll take it. Any relief from the heat.
Absolutely. So without further ado, let's get into this. I am so excited to introduce this evening's guest. We have Dr. Jennifer Manlow. And since the mid-1990s, she has worked as a professor, an author, a chaplain, and a life clarity coach. She is a licensed family therapist, and she holds a master's of divinity and a PhD in psychology and religion with specialization in gender. Now, as a secular systems therapist, her sole focus is on supporting people eager to be connected to others and themselves with greater courage and authenticity. And a common denominator for clients she sees, remember she is a member of the Secular Therapy Project, is they are experiencing an important life transition. And most relevant for today is that the clients she sees who are navigating some form of psycho-spiritual or existential crisis of meaning and identity after being raised in a religious tradition for which they can no longer abide. So, Jen, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. And I have to ask, what got you started studying trauma and religion? How did you get into this? Tell us everything.
Thank you so much, Kara. And just a pleasure to meet everyone. I wish we could touch elbows, I guess. I just can't thank you enough, Kara, for all the support you've given me as I prepare for this conversation. Thank you, Glenda Trollstomper, Gail, Daryl, Nikki, volunteer, all these fabulous people that have co-created this wonderful organization. So exciting. And Kara, wow, you're a gift. So I just want to say thank you so much all. How did I get in? Well, I think I got into studying trauma and religion by being a questioner, even as a young person. I was raised Catholic, and we went to church 6 days a week, on our knees 6 days every morning, 6 days a week.
Wait, in person, in church, 6 days a week?
Yes. So deep into my marrow went that bodily ritual, right? Knees, stand, beat your chest. I'm not worthy. Okay. Before communion, you have to say you're not worthy. You have to ask for forgiveness. You have to not eat an hour before, which is the real trick. So sacrifice, self-abnegation, and, you know, again, from my perspective, it looked like groveling, you know. So as a young person, I didn't know different. It was what I was born into. But I did question, what are all those men doing up there on the altar? Isn't that supposed to be where Jesus is, you know? And my mom would be like, oh, they represent Jesus, you know. And, you know, which again is not doctrine, that is not Catholic doctrine, but, you know, it was kind of to shush me. So one time, again, I was sort of envious of their freedom to speak. And I remember thinking, I have a lot of questions, and I would try to ask people in class, what's the deal with the triune Holy Spirit God and Jesus, you know, that's supposed to be the triune God. God's three in one. I don't get it, you know, et cetera. So I would ask tough questions. And the funny thing is, I was a very serious child, duh. But when my dog died, that was a real existential, what's it all about? And as we know here, I think it's Gail, or I can't remember, Glenda, who has those dogs in the picture here. Gail's daughter, Glenda. So Glenda, I love dogs pretty much more than people. But so when my dog died, I had a little crisis of meaning. And I thought, what good God would take a dog like our precious Clarence, you know? And I would just mope about the house, you know, pretty much, you know, Lisa Simpson, you know, head on the table, you know, just like, I can't go on, you know. But I really thought there can't be a good God if something so heinous could happen to our precious dog, hit by a car. So anyway, so this is the beginning of saying, I don't know if there is a God. And my mom's like, oh, there is, you'll find out, you know, at some point, but have faith. And I just thought, I can't pretend. So that was around age 7. Around age 10, a liberation theologian, Portuguese from Brazil, priest, came to our church and asked, you know, he talked about liberation for the poor. He talked about that no one can know God outside of the service they and the loving kindness they experience. So he was part doctor, part priest, I mean, obviously both, but really interested in helping people feel empowered through hygiene, through medical care, through housing, you know, really good, one of those great Catholics. And there are some wonderful Catholics, as y'all know, the Dorothy Day, the worker movement, you know, there are tons of good Mary Knoll sisters helping uprisings, you know, so there are some good ones. But this one I thought was really talking my language. The God of love is one you can sense, not necessarily be convinced by. And so he said, we need more priests. This was probably the time Catholics were thinning out in terms of clergy. But he said, who here wants to be a priest? And very few, I don't even think anyone raised their hand, but I did. I go, I want to be a priest. And I was so excited. I really did feel called or moved, like, oh my gosh, this makes so much sense. I'm a questioner. I want to help people. I'm into medicine. You know, I really was one of those kids that had a doll that was had veins and stuff, you know, those clear dolls. So I was very kind of a serious kid, obviously. But I really thought, this is it. This makes so much sense. This is my calling. So anyway, I moved along and was told by, not by that priest, but by my parish priest, girls, females cannot be priests. And I thought, what? And he said, yeah, girls can't be priests. And I said, well, I've been called. I've really been called. No, there is no doubt about it. And he said, and he maybe giggled. And I thought, he's wrong, which is kind of exciting that I had the agency to say, well, you're wrong, sir. And what I thought was, this organization called the parish on this island, they're mistaken. I didn't know that it was a universal thing for Catholics. I just thought this house, the house of God here, is mistaken. And for 4 years, I prepared for becoming a priest. Again,
oh, you were just going ahead with it anyway.
Radically self-authorizing. I just love it. Now, don't forget, this is the 1973. So the feminist movement must have been in the air. But I had a little altar in a corner of my room. I had rosary beads. We weren't allowed to use the Bible pre-Vatican II, but I had a little missalette, you know, those little things that help you with liturgy. I had a little outreach campaign for the runaways. I mean, I was serious and it didn't pass. You know how someone wants to be a firefighter and then the next day they want to be a chef or a go-go dancer. I think we have a few of those here. You know, I didn't change. I really, really had a conviction that I want to be a priest and bring God's love into the world through physical help, you know, not just rhetoric about Jesus saves. But anyway, I hope I'm not going on too long here. We've only gotten to age 10.
No, this is fascinating. I love this, that you were going forward with it regardless of what the priesthood had to say about it. Yes. And I can see how this is gonna lead to a crisis at some point.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah. By the time I'm 14, still serious about it, we moved as a family to another place, another island. And I thought, oh, good, that box, that house will be able to train me because I'm eager to be trained. Okay. Well, I get there and they say, no, women can't be ordained. And I thought, so you're wrong too? Like, I really couldn't believe it
but these people are not hearing from God. Apparently they're not getting the same message you are. What's like, going
what
on
is your phone number? You're not picking up what I'm hearing. So anyway, long short, real quickly, I just went off the deep end with rage. And I would say a good maybe 3 years, I did a lot of drinking, a lot of smoking pot, a lot of hooking up with folk that would steal cars, just really nasty, hopeless, really severely hopeless, and lost. As we know, this is why I'm into what happens when we're leaving or thinking of leaving our tradition. Like, I had a crisis of purpose, of meaning, of identity. Who am I without conviction?
Mm-hmm. Wow. So once you realized that this was not something that the church was going to allow you to do, that was just, it sounds like there was nothing left. You were just immediately, it's like your life's dream was dashed.
Absolutely. It's just really spun. And, you know, I mean, again, I like knitting, but I didn't want to be a knitter. You know, I mean, this was my true passion. Yes, this was a nightmare. Someone just wrote, sounds like a nightmare.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days. And now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering from Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.
Yeah, and so where do we go from here? Well, I just, I guess I thought I'm gonna keep learning about it because I want to expose it. I want to expose the lie. And I honestly had a conversion out of it into studying the wrongness of their ideas. It's kind of like being in a debate with your dad. And I will say my dad was a real arguer and not very nice, very sexist. And, you know, as I look at it, when we track the tales by the early church fathers, I like to say, and mothers, but the early church fathers really promoted terrible, terrible things about women's worth. And so, you know, one of them is by Origen, a second and third century Greek father. Many should not sit and listen to a woman, even if she says admirable things or even saintly things. That is of little consequence, since it came from the mouth of a woman. My other very favorite one comes from Tertullian. He says, do you know what you are? Each are an Eve. You women are an Eve. The sentence of God on this sex of yours lives in this age. The guilt must of necessity live too. You are the devil's gateway. You are the unsealer of that forbidden tree. You are the first deserter of divine law. You are she who persuaded him whom the devil was not valiant enough to attack. You destroyed so easily God's image, man, on account of your desert. That is that, you know, that you deserted. That is death. Even the Son of God had to die because of you. And do you think about adorning yourself over and above your tunics and skins? Meaning, do you really believe your worth being taken seriously as a religious? So that's my heritage, Catholic tradition.
Yeah.
And that's just one of many horrifying things that I've heard in the tradition by clergy.
Well, and that is just, you know, incredibly damning, you know, when people want to say, oh, no, it's not coming from sexism. It's because whatever, our doctrine respects women and wants to protect them. No, that is clearly not the reason for excluding women at all. That is a complete lie. That is, just shocking. And, and to think that we're still dealing with this, you know, today, this is still an argument people are having. It's just utterly outrageous. I can't even.
I hear you. And I love that a chat person just said, Eve wasn't even created, but, you know, or came after the creation, you know? So it's like, what the hell? What is he thinking? But you know what? They were very threatened by women's leadership, as was Paul in the New Testament. We hear of Paul, a figure named Paul, who was the real founder of, you know, making Christianity an organization. So starting the 10th churches was organized by him, a convert to Christianity. Many of you probably know that. But anyway, many female leaders influenced him and mentored him, etc. But, you know, as far as we know, again, we don't know, did he even exist? But the people that were his students, what are called Pauline writers, had a lot of problems with women and wrote that they should be quiet. They should, you know, keep their hair covered. They should, you know, bow to men. They should see themselves as led and disciplined by men. Be quiet, quite frankly. The man is the head and the woman is the body. So this headless woman, apparently. but yes, it's a disturbing thing to dig into misogyny in all religions, but I think in the Christian text is my area, Christian theology.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I know when we were, you know, describing your background, you've obviously studied that, you know, even more in depth after your experiences. I take it that was what prompted you to look into it further. And Yeah. So,
seminary.
Okay. So you completed seminary, and at that point in time, had you already essentially left your faith and you were at this point studying it in order to argue with it, or were you still 100%. Kind of believing? Oh no, you were already past it.
Even in college, I took women in law, you know, psychology, all kinds of classes, but the woman in law professor at the University of Washington said, study with an organization that helps women. And so I found a clergy person that helps educate clergy on domestic violence. And so I wanted to be like her.
Okay.
And she went to a good school. And so I thought I'll go to a school like that. And then I'll study and teach clergy just like her. You know how you don't know, you know?
Yeah.
So I get to seminary and I don't want to work in a square church. I want to work in domestic violence specialty. So I created a chaplain position, you know, training, because the seminary wasn't interested in domestic violence, as you might guess.
I'm shocked.
But I was able to co-create with another to have that be one of an internship a person could take. So anyway, as you might imagine, tons of pushback from Princeton, tons of pushback with clergy I worked with. And it didn't stop with religion. In philosophy, the same thing. So I got my doctorate of philosophy and studied psychology and religion. And even my feminist advisors said, I don't think you should write on trauma and religion. You'll never get a job.
Ha, and here you are.
I had to do it, as you can see.
I just love that this has been the story of your life. People are telling you no, and you're saying, yeah, just go ahead and watch me.
And since age 7, you know, I'm sure it was probably earlier than that.
That is fantastic. I love that. I bet your parents didn't, but.
Oh, no. You know. And a lot of name calling for that. And by a sexist father, he would say mean things, really mean things, like you're an idiot. You know,
ooh,
don't be a whore. He had a lot of, he was basically Donald Trump. I hope I haven't offended anyone.
No, you're fine. But yeah, that is so upsetting. And, you know, I can see exactly how that happened. If they're, you know, buying into all of the misogyny in the texts and the doctrine that they're getting, and, you know, they see you challenging that, of course, they're going to put that right back to you and say, oh, no, you're supposed to be quiet. You're supposed to be submissive. You're doing it wrong. You're being a bad Christian or whatever. I mean, it's almost shocking that you left the faith. I'm being sarcastic, of course.
Right.
But wow. So, well, you mentioned, so after you did kind of leave behind this, this was a big part of your identity growing up. You were going to be a minister and everything, and it turned out they didn't want to let you do that. You know, what were some of the difficulties that caused for you? You kind of alluded a little bit to it, but what are some of the struggles that can come from that?
Oh, you know, especially when you're told you're crazy, you're very difficult. I mean, I was told some things like that by, you know, we have to train you intern, right? So I'd intern, and they mandated interning in a church. And this guy was, no, you want to use inclusive language, forget it. Just not, and we're not going to let you do anything that would be prepare you. So we're going to put you up with the little kids, which is fine. We need ministers or whatever, meaning kind people for little kids. But I did not want to work with little kids. So anyway, the long and short, it had me doubt myself, but not enough. I definitely said, well, these people need help. This is how I left seminary. Nothing really changed, right? I thought, these clergy people really need help. Maybe I should be a psychiatrist and help these crazy people. And so I became a psychologist of religion, psychology and religion professor, thinking I'm going to help people who have trouble believing and don't know what to do with their life because they're discombobulated or whatnot. And so I did train to be a therapist as well as the doctorate. But I, because like you say, Kara, I had so much mixed messages kind of scrambling in here, that I didn't feel like I'd be a very good therapist because I'm healing, you know, too, right? Mm-hmm. So I didn't know that good therapists are healing too, You know, I didn't realize they don't have to be, there's no such thing as healed, right? But I was young. So it took me another 34 years to become a therapist.
Wow. And
so that gives you a sense of how good I felt about myself. I felt I had to be healthier than I was. And, you know, now I look at it, there's a social reason I wasn't healthy, you know, that it's a social construction of gender conditioning made sacred by the church. But that gender conditioning is everywhere. Yeah. And sexist and homophobic conditioning we're swimming in it. So to climb out of that, it wasn't just the square house of God, so to speak. It was the world around me. And of course, if you were surrounded by conservative folk, they're going to tell you a bunch of things that aren't true about women and men, and that the real man, I know you got men here, know what it's like to be told the real man is the head of the household. The real man wants to be married by your age. You know, the real man wants to be a father. And provide. You're like, these things are oppressive to men too.
Oh, absolutely. And I love how the same people who will sit there and tell you that you're not a real man or a real woman if you don't do, you know, the following 87,000 things are the same people that don't recognize gender as a social construct. That absolutely baffles me to no end.
Right. Absolutely.
But, you know, and I just feel like it's so kind of profound what you pointed out there that, you know, even though you never bought into the sexism and the misogyny, you always rejected it, you always fought against it, yet it still impacted you throughout your entire life through the messaging that you kept getting and through the structural barriers to your advancement and everything like that. You didn't even have to believe it in order for it to get in your brain and in the world around you and have an impact. And that's so distressing to hear.
And it had a bodily impact. I was both angry and confused. Like, how do I be in the world if being female is really blocking me from some of the stuff I want to do? Yeah. But I didn't, in those days, we didn't have so much the discourse of questioning gender. Even among feminists, it wasn't a big thing, the gender plurality and gender as performance. That didn't come until at least 10 years after I was graduated. Mm-hmm. But I was very much, how do I feel worthwhile if I'm female? Mm-hmm. I'm just not getting any feedback here. This is telling me you're a worthwhile being. Yeah. So I just had a lot of doubt, and it did come out on the body. And the rage and the longing for worth, mixed messages of who's worthy, what's a good woman, you know, what's a strong woman, you know, she's a good mother, you know. I'm like, well, I don't want to do that. What do I do? So anyway, little by little, I just would interview people and see my first book, Faith Born of Seduction, looking at sexual trauma in religious homes, looking at eating disorders in religious homes, and the sort of the discourse of sacrifice and you know, the good woman deprives herself and puts others first, you know, et cetera. So I looked at sexual abuse in religious homes and churches and bodily effects and how our religious imagination, even after leaving, obviously, it haunts us. It's kind of like a ghost that won't go away. No matter how radical, revolutionary we could be, it's still there. It took me a lot of questioning that voice that said, this could be the devil you're listening to. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. some of us are in real conservative traditions where mm-hmm. they say, you've let the devil get in. No wonder, you know, no wonder your life won't come together. You know, no wonder people don't, whatever. I kept thinking things that weren't going well were punishment, even though I didn't believe a patriarchal God. So you kind of get the double binds we get in.
Right. Yeah. The indoctrination still got into you, even though you were intellectually rejecting it. It's still in there in your body.
Absolutely.
And yeah. And I found that so interesting. I went out and read several chapters of your book, That Faith Born of Seduction, as soon as you told me about it. And I found that to be so fascinating. I was wondering, could you talk a little bit more about some of the like embodiment of some of this indoctrination and how it affected people in terms of like body image and things like that?
Yeah. One of the primary things was, questioning, well, am I the cause of the death of humanity? You know, the Eve story, obviously. Now I'm talking about people raised Catholic, mostly, some Protestant Christians, some charismatic Christians, and they all had a different template of enthusiasm for what they've been able to remember that was good, mm-hmm. but the toxicity had left scars, and the fighting for agency was taboo. Mm-hmm. So what they would often do as young people was fight for agency through saying, you can't make me, right? You can't make me. So like a lot of that, so they're saying no a lot to things they might, if encouraged, would say yes to, like their desire, like their sexuality, like their, you know, sexual, their appetites, you know, food. I mean, any passion beyond the passion to emulate Christ, you know, some of us know that kind of religion. So I really saw a lot of wrestling with impulse, wrestling with desire, and then secretly indulging those impulses and then feeling like a sinner. So we have the kind of addiction cycle and then the self-loathing and then the repentance through some kind of self-deprivation or even self-harm.
Okay. Yeah. I can absolutely see the connection here that you made to eating disorders potentially being a result of this. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that came up in your interviews, correct?
Oh, yes. 9 interviews with women, and each of them traumatized sexually by someone who told them that they needed to be obedient to God's will, and that if they talk about it, they're disobeying the Father. And that the organ is, you know, the tradition is obey thy father, one of the commandments, you know. A lot of them, you know, now more than ever, we're seeing documentaries like this. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have seen Obey.
Yes, Obey. I did watch that one recently. That was awful. Yes.
Keep sweet, obey, pray. So there was that kind of message to girls that I interviewed. But they also, every single one of them had an eating disorder. So that's in part why I really said that symptom of trauma can be eating disorders, addictions, self-injury, hooking up with folk that are dangerous, putting yourself in danger, wishing you were dead because you can't even leave the tradition or leave behind the messages. And so that's what got me kind of into mental health. How can I help people get free from the toxicity and its after effects? And I don't believe we're ever totally free. And Kara, you were talking and I was saying that our religious heritage can be like a petri dish. Mm-hmm. When we leave it, we still have that goo, right? And we can't wholly be separate. You know, and even in any kind of philosophy, we know we're part of each other, right? Interdependent. So I don't exist as a separate self, like I'm hatched out of an egg and now I've left the nest. You know, we don't get to leave our religious or philosophical or psychological context in a pure way. Mm-hmm. There will always be residue, and we work with it. This is how I've seen in my clients. I asked them, what hinders and what helps? And a lot of them said community, having a critical thinking community, being part of a group like you guys offer, support groups, right?
Yes.
For recovering from religion. That was pivotal in all 9 of the women.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that is really good to know. I mean, it's sad that so many people are dealing with this, but you know, I am really pleased to know that that really is helpful to people, because that's something that, you know, we can provide.
It's wonderful. Thank God, because I'm telling you, there's high suicide. Yeah. And you know what? I looked more up to date statistics, and suicide, believe it or not, isn't more dominant in religious traditions. It's when people don't have community. So when folks leave a religious tradition, they don't have community as easily. So it's that post-leaving community of support, loving kindness, you know, holding the space for you to find what's true for you versus feeding you what you need to believe and you know, adapt to.
Yeah. Well, that is so powerful to know that. And, you know, it's kind of hokey, but I want to plug again our services for community that we provide with RFR. If this is resonating with anyone, don't forget to check us out. We have the support groups and the online community. It's here for that purpose. And of course, you know, we're here every Monday night to be able to just get together and have that community. So don't forget to check us out at recoveringfromreligion.org. But also, there's so many other types of community that people can get involved in too, I'm sure. Did you have any examples of things that people had tried to find community post-religion?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Normally, you know, some were drawn to 12-step programs. Mm-hmm. And change the language to higher purpose, you know, higher power, mm-hmm. higher purpose. Mm-hmm. Or they change the language to be, I want to be a person that practices the spirit of generosity. So they would find their own words that didn't feel like abandoning to their truth. I think that's the big deal, is it's so important to suss out what's true for our experience. No matter, mm-hmm. I mean, and to honor that it will be wavy. It's not like it's, oh, now I found my true self. Not at all, but more, what of my past do I want to weave in to the narrative I'm writing mm-hmm. now? And mm-hmm. what can I question critically and leave behind as a tragic aspect of my past, mm-hmm. and that has informed me, but doesn't have to inform my future or define my future, I should say.
Oh, yeah. You know, so, I think that's,
you know, writing groups, journaling, again, finding, even, you know, the higher purpose doesn't, it could be, you know, volunteering at a cat rescue place. It doesn't have to be. I did a lot with social organizing around gender justice, around violence mm-hmm. against women. Mm-hmm. And I find a lot of survivors do that, or they'll they'll go to fight back classes and then learn that they want to help other women, perhaps, and men who have been traumatized, people who've been traumatized. So there's kind of a mission. As I get well, I want to help others. And I want the inside work to go out in the world and not just stay inside, like so many in, you know, dialogical therapy can keep you inside yourself. It doesn't necessarily launch you to be terribly engaged in the world. And I'm one of those therapists that says we can't build a life without right relationship. Mm-hmm. So finding a meditation group, finding a non-theistic, you know, support group that isn't going to throw down what's true for you mm-hmm. and shake their finger. I told you before about textile arts. I mean, it can be anything that gives you joy and contributes to a larger sense of self than I'm a wounded trauma survivor, you know?
Yeah.
Yes, getting outside, and so hard post-COVID, because a lot of us, as a colleague of mine, have turned to kind of conspiracy, right? Mm. We turned to cultic things that seem to be the answer, you know? Mm-hmm. It could be drugs and alcohol too. It doesn't have to necessarily be cultish, but something to help cope with our isolation inside mm-hmm. and feelings of loss post-pandemic. And now getting out in the world is scary for people.
Yeah, it was bad enough before, but yeah, I know I'm probably guilty of it too. You know, I need to relearn how to socialize with the humans in person again after all this time in COVID.
And Zoom is a beginning, you know, to get comfortable taking turns, you know, letting each other learn from each other. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, I want to kind of back up a little bit here and ask you, like, what do you think are some of the kind of signs and symptoms that people should look for that might suggest that they have been affected by religious trauma in some way and maybe needing to seek out some of these things?
Right. Well, I think the big ones are, does your tradition foster an unquestioning commitment to the leader, right? Those are symptoms you're in a cult, a destructive religion. The modern discourse today isn't cult so much as modern religion. I think that's kind of a weak thing, but apparently it's less offensive. So this idea, is questioning okay? Are you able to doubt, or are you encouraged to ask questions? Or are you threatened of being excommunicated or followed, or, you know, things we see with some of the documentaries, Scientology documentaries, right? Is there leadership telling you how to dress, how to think, how to feel, how to act, who you should marry, who you should be with, what kind of people you should even like, you know? Does it say things about sexuality and gender that have you wondering what century you're living in? Does the leader have sex with the members? That's a good one. And, under veil or not, as we've seen with the atrocities of sexual violence of children, that's a huge problem across traditions. And do they have an us versus them mentality? This is so interesting because I do believe in the time of Trump, there's such an us versus them mentality that is a flame that is fanned over and over every time certain people open their mouth. Are they queerphobic, racist? Do they promote one nation? As we see with the, I believe it's Texas, and I'm sorry if I'm wrong, but that trying to get God into the classroom and in God we trust on buildings and in public schools, and do they have a mission? Is money at the does it seem like political manipulation and money making, ever-growing material wealth seem to be a big plot? And again, do you feel fear for your life if you were to leave? Finally, do you have waves of suicidal ideation? Because a lot of times when we're even in a battered relationship, battering relationship, we'll feel like the only way we can leave is to die. And so I do love that you also here at RFRX have resources for people that are feeling lost and that they need to talk to someone and right now. And I also have that in the notes. What to do if you feel any of these things that have you feeling so stuck, you don't know what to do next, like you're in stepping in tar, you know?
Yeah. Sounds like you've dealt quite a bit with that. And I know you've kind of described a little bit of, you know, this in terms of the bite model before. Did you want to go into any detail about that?
That's okay. I'd love to share my screen. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Please do. I know we've kind of talked a little bit about that before, and I know that's a model that you've worked with a few times. So please, lay it on us.
Yes. So this model is developed by Stephen Hassan, a former cult member of the Unification Church, known as the Moonies in popular lore, the guys that, the priest that marries 10,000 people in one sitting. I'm just wondering, what kind of dollars do you get for that? So put your religious tradition through this lens and see whether you tilt left or right. And I don't mean politically, but does your tradition, is it constructive or is it destructive? Because what's considered a cult is any tradition that's destructive. It could be an organization. So it's not just religions he's talking about, but if it's constructive, it will promote your authentic self. It will convey unconditional love and foster the same for you. It will be conscious, you know, conscious. It won't try to drug you or have you shut off to your awareness. It'll be creative humor. You'll have free will. Obviously, you do have free will, but it won't threaten that. You'll be able to think critically. You'll have healthy mentors, perhaps. The leaders will know their limits, that they'll be able to be people who champion others and their power using it responsibly. The leaders will be people that live what they preach. They'll be accountable to the people they serve. And for any relationship, really, and organizations, there'll be checks and balances. There'll be no one true leader. There'll be informed consent, that, you know, that nothing has to happen without agreement, and often by the whole. Individuality will be okay. Uniqueness and diversity will be celebrated. There'll be a growth model that isn't about material. You know, certainly people want to grow their organization, but it won't just be to amass wealth at the top. As you can see, this can happen for organizations too. You'll always be free to leave, and it won't be with a wink, you know.
Yeah, I'm getting like some MLM vibes here. Exactly. As well.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
And even some hippie love, you know, the love community here, we had one. It was harsh. It was, you can't leave if you want to be about love. You have to have sex with me if you want to practice love. So even things that we might think of free, you know, in the old days, free hippie love child, you know, in no way am I dissing hippies, because they were my examples in the 70s. But I'm talking when it gets to that kind of commune, culty place that is not about justice or fairness or inclusivity. Mm. So yeah, if your tradition had a kind of false identity presented one way and had a whole other thing going on, if love was conditional, if the doctrine was narrow, if there was fear and guilt at every turn, you weren't allowed to be silly. You couldn't mock the tradition. That's a good sign. You can mock your tradition. Dependency and obedience, you know, that was a battered relationship, right? So as long as you do what I say, I will protect you. Obedience, you know, stay sweet. Mm. The leaders are narcissistic, possibly psychopathic, meaning they have no moral compass for what they do. Mm-hmm. Are they elitist? Do they have, in some mega churches, they have parking for the big donors, and most of the big donors drive gold, you know, designer cars and have the gold car parking lot. Are they grandiose? Do they pump themselves up? Do they ask for more money? Do they have jets? Are they power hungry, secretive, deceptive? Do they claim to have the voice of God? The organization, again, in relationships, is it authoritarian, deceptive, manipulative? Does it try to make clones of people? The ends justify the means. By any means necessary, they create obedience and servitude to preserve their own power. And is there, you know, they tell you there's no legitimate reason to leave. Mm-hmm. And so that has you questioning yourself. But I did want to say that there are signs, and you had asked about that, and I don't mm-hmm. know if you want to talk about it maybe later, but.
Oh, no, absolutely. Go ahead. Yeah.
You know, so you guys get the gist of, is my religious heritage, did it lean to the building me up or tearing me down? That's one of the nice ways to ask in a quick way. Did mm-hmm. it build up a sense of radical inclusivity and loving kindness, or did it promote narrow righteousness? There's only one way and the rest are punished. And that, you know, that's my heritage.
Sadly, a lot of that sounds very familiar to me as well. I bet it does to a lot of other people. I'm seeing some comments in the chat that people are recognizing some of their past experiences in these descriptions too.
And you grew up Protestant, didn't you, Carol?
Yes, I did. Southern Baptist megachurch. And we also did the Bill Gothard stuff for a while too.
Wow.
Yeah.
He had quite an expose too.
Yes. And so many of the things you're mentioning up there are right in line with all of that. I would say that that whole IBLP, Institute and Basic Life Principles, that was the Bill Gothard organization, probably ticks a large number of the boxes that you just mentioned.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And mega churches too are just very disturbing. Again, I sort of see it as a prequel. I hope it's okay to mention that I think Trump fits one of these leaders. He's been told he's the chosen, you know, by some of these people, and he's championed his chosen status. God chose me to lead, just like David in the, you know, Hebrew Bible.
Yeah, and of course at RFR, we don't, you know, advocate any particular politicians or anything like that. All comments are your own, et cetera. but disclaimer,
grain of salt.
Yes. But I mean, having said that, no, I have seen what you're describing too. A lot of the mega churches have gotten involved in politics, it would seem, you know, in this way that you're describing, which is interesting.
Right.
To see that. Yes.
And, you know, in terms of, you know, the after effects too, I'm going to stop share. The after effects that you and I had spoken of also, I think are really important. I can just touch on them quickly about when we've lost our sense of authenticity, what that does to us when if we leave and or don't have community. After feeling semi-brainwashed or manipulated with toxic beliefs, it becomes, you know, like we're in stuck in a white room without anything on the walls to be inventive, you know. And it's like, well, what do I draw from my palette from the past? You know, I'm seeing like these seven difficult things that really have me not loving myself at all. And you're telling me I have to draw what's next, and I don't have any, you know, I am lost, right? So some of the after effects are a sense of, you know, true feelings of loss and grief too, you know, that which, you know, could have been a place I did everything, you know, I might have played in the church choir. I might, you know, there are a whole bunch of ways that we get embedded that are tough to disentangle and know what's next for us. Mm-hmm. So one of them, I'm just going to say them quickly, a sense of purposelessness, feeling disconnected, feeling depressed, grieving again for people who are still in the tradition. And some of that can be family that have excommunicated me. Mm-hmm. Guilt for even having been brainwashed. And I use that word in quotes, but, you know, guilt. For I can't even believe I let that person tell me I'm an idiot and a whore like Eve. You know, I'm like, I thought, well, number one, you're wrong, but I didn't say anything back to him. So, I mean, sometimes, you know, it's kind of like being on a date and someone crosses the line and you think, did I flirt with you? Because I was told that, right? I'm brainwashed to believe I have the power to seduce your violence against me.
Oh, 100%. That was one of the big things that I took away from my indoctrination as well, was this idea that whatever happens to you, well, it was probably your fault. You're like Eve, you know. Mm-hmm. Wow, that is so harmful.
And yeah, why aren't you very smart? You know, here you and I both have PhDs. But it's like, you're so smart. Why'd you stay? you know? Mm-hmm. So a lot of these are victim blaming, but the other is to feel like I've not only lost family perhaps, but friends, and then making new friends, if it's cult-like tradition, they're like, are you kidding me? You know, again, you believe that? So it's hard to feel like I'm a smart, good person when I could have been indoctrinated. And so it can, as I say, bring up similar shame. You can feel very isolated. Some of us, you know, if I, you know, had a religious job and now I have to look for another one, I don't want to have that on my, you know, Christian counselor or something. I would be devastated to have that on my resume, because that is not like the chaplain thing. I normally don't have that on any of my descriptors because it's my past. But not only that, I don't want to be associated with promoting one tradition or any steering people towards one religion or any religion. But anyway, so isolation, distrust, again, distrust of self, but also distrust of those that are, let's say, charismatic. Maybe you're going to meet a lover or something who's very passionate about whatever. And like, is that me who wants to do that? They love fishing. Maybe I do too. You know what I mean? So you kind of learn to doubt, is this me or them? So just really tragic. Same with businesses that tell you, we're a big family here. You know, we're one big family. It's like, what does that mean to you? Yeah. I always go, so you had a drunk at the head of the table?
Right. Like, are you going to expect me to produce more employees and work for free? Do I need to go clean the kitchen now?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, I don't like this metaphor at all.
Not at all. And the other is, you know, with fear of going crazy. I wrote a book called Cracking Up, Notes of a Good Girl Gone Mad. And it has double message there. Cracking up laughing or cracking up mentally. Good girl gone mad, you know, Catholic girl gone crazy, or a person who believed the lies getting angry now. And so that book is also available. And I did self-publish that book. So I made it really cheap.
Hey, there you go.
But so yeah, it's just the shedding the dualistic framework, you know, black, white, male, female, pure, unpure, good, evil, male, female, all of this is hard to shake off. And then finally, spiritualizing everything and feeling like you are saying, Kara, is it me? Maybe there is a spirit and I've not done the right thing and I'm being punished now because of that person I dated, or, you know, so-and-so fired me. Why? Maybe God wants to get me back in the fold, you know? So it's, we can really mind manipulation. And it doesn't have to be because I'm in a cult. It could be that my tradition was very successful promoting its doctrines. And this is something to be questioned. In no way would I say, leave your religion. You've heard me from here. You know, I'm more saying, see what is building you up in your tradition. Are there people there that champion your agency and your who you love? You know, can you love who you love? Can you want to be child free? You know, I mean, our Supreme Court has 6 Catholics on it. And one of them has been called a handmaiden.
So, literal handmaiden. That just blows my mind. Yeah. And I don't know about you, but I mean, I remember growing up, that was a big deal. I never wanted children. And that was not okay. That was like, there's something wrong with you and you're going to have children anyway. We don't care if you want them or not. Like, it was just expected that if you have a vagina, your job is to push babies out of it, was pretty much the messaging we got. Yeah, when you think about it, that's really violent. Absolutely. I mean, bodily autonomy, not a thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
And shame about it. I don't know if anyone here can relate, but I was told I'm selfish.
Mm-hmm.
selfish. You just get up and think about what you want to do that day. And I'm like, God, you mean like most men on the planet?
Yeah.
Wait a second. How dare I?
Right.
I really had a born again Catholic tell me that. So yeah, and how much we have to climb uphill to not go with the lemmings, you know, and not judge them either. I mean, I shouldn't have used the word lemmings, but I try to not judge family who've chosen to stay in the tradition. I try to see that it gives them structure, it gives them a sense of making sense of the world, why there's good and evil, why they're going to go to a good place after all their earthly suffering, why they, you know, be obedient because it makes the mean guy nicer, you know, all this. It's God's will. So some people, it's just like, oh, well, that explains sexism in my workplace. I just sort of adapt like I'm supposed to. So yeah, as I said, it can just eat at you, and I believe it's lifelong. The recovery process is lifelong, so that we need to keep helping each other to stay in our choice, stay in our worth, stay in helping the next person. I'm big on, it's not just about me getting free, but how can I help the next person find their voice, find their sense of courage to trust themselves, or begin to, I always say, reason it out with someone you trust, you know, rather than someone who's told you what you think or what you think.
Well, and yeah, like what else can you tell us about that? You mentioned community as well as being one of those key things that helps people come out of this. What are some other sort of coping strategies or things that you found helpful as you were kind of digging yourself out of all of this?
Well, I have another little handy flyer. I mean, not flyer. I have a handy little image, and I don't know. I'm hoping I can share it with y'all if you let me.
Sure. Yeah, and absolutely.
I kind of made it my own. So I don't think I'm violating anything here. But so can y'all see this?
Yes, we can see that.
Okay, so this is a gauge for me that I give to every one of my clients. Is your not only your tradition, but is your sense of balance okay? Like, how are you doing? In this case, questioning, you know, it doesn't have to be really, it could be your ethics. Are you looking for what you do value? Are you, you know, doing things that serve you in terms of self-care? You know, what's liberating to you in what you believe? It doesn't obviously have to be a tradition. What are you doing to grow your intellect, your critical thinking? You know, are you letting yourself be physically active? Are you returning to things that bring liveliness and oxygen to you? And this includes sleeping. You know, a lot of people in fear, we just struggle to sleep. And I'm a big one on get off, you know, your media or your screen time, you know, manage your screen time if you can, because it eats at our imagination and isolates us. So I'm opinionate about that. That's not necessarily fact. So emotionally, what are you doing to stay close to your, again, your voice? Are you attending to that part of you that you look to others maybe to nurture? Are you nurturing it? Again, sleeping? Are you getting therapy? That this stuff isn't going to go away by you just moving to a new neighborhood. Financially, do you feel like you're tending to yourself? You know, are you talking to people that could support you in managing? I know as a woman raised in a conservative tradition, it wasn't even thought that you're going to manage your money. It's like, you know, women couldn't even get a credit card in my mother's life.
Which is so ironic to me, because I'm like you, I liked to argue back with people about it. I got told that all the time. And yet at the same time, you know, a lot of people in my tradition would promote that you want to be the Proverbs 30 woman or Proverbs 31. I can't remember which one it is. And in that, you know, she's managing a business and money, and somehow that gets left out. You know, well, we didn't mean that. Do the other things.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's not even internally consistent, you know, when you get the people basically telling you the misogyny. Right. But yeah, sorry to interject there. I got excited when you said that.
No problem. And as you know, I believe the social emotional should not be separate words or separate pie pieces. You know, this is again, I work with 20 somethings who have still wait for mom to wake them up. So, you know, are you taking care of your environment? Do you see a larger world than yourself? I think that's another one about environment. What keeps you going? And again, when I say find your higher purpose, I might say greater good. What part do you want to play in adding to the greater good? And sometimes that means, you know, as I say, I've invited someone to do a beach cleanup. You know what I mean? Like there are little things we can do that join other people who have good hearts. And that's ultimately what I thought the whole spiritual thing was about. But I can find other people who want to make the world a better place. And, you know, as long as I don't have to buoy up the leader and believe everything they say, I could be part of something that helps enliven people and the planet and myself. But I do think it means taking my pulse as to what do I desire. I was not taught to look at what I desire. I was taught to fear what I desire. Mm-hmm. That's where we just question, maybe I like photography, maybe I like you know, as I say, some of my clients are making their own little gardens, and, you know, we've used the metaphor of what we plant seeds that we want to see grow. And we also weed for a lifetime, right? I'm going to have to weed out that mean voice, and I'm going to have to accept that this is a lifestyle questioning, practicing dignity and worth, even if I don't feel it.
Ooh, I like that. Practicing dignity and worth, even if you don't feel it. That's really good.
And building up others, you know, folk who come here, you can help other people here. And that can build your esteem. Any esteeming act builds self-esteem. And any courageous, something that's kind of scary that you do, is going to grow you. And so, like I'm saying, like it can be as simple as going into the grocery aisle that there are people in instead of the electronic one, you know, like yes. I always say, let's start simple. so like anything that gets us a little outside of the fear self that is part of the traumatic symptom of I'm not safe in this world, you know?
Yeah.
Extraordinary power protecting me and judging me, you know, about what's good and right and wrong, then I at least know the, like bumpers on a bowling alley, I can play the game of life and I know wrong and right. And so when we don't have that rigidity, it's like, well, how am I going to play the game of life? You know, is there another sport?
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I love how you put that though. Just getting out there and doing the things, even if it's just something simple, but taking those steps forward. That is really nice. I really loved how you said that. Wait, say it again. It was practicing dignity and respect, even if you don't feel it.
Dignity and worth, even if you dignity don't feel it. Just act as if you have it. Yeah. And the other is esteemable acts create self-esteem. So what are esteemable acts? They're doing things that scare us a little, and they don't have to be big things. I'm so much a believer of small little acts. And you know, one of your people on, I think it's episode 124 or 126, talks about small challenges, and you know, it's a progressive preacher who tried to kill himself and have an overdose when he tried to leave his faith. And he got back into creating a progressive church that's queer, supportive, and works with homeless and whatnot, and is not at all about promoting any religion, but it's just a space for people to come. Anyway, he found his voice, but boy, did he walk through some dark tunnels. And anyway, one of the things he says is do something that's challenging, even one little thing. Make sure it's simple because you want to get traction.
Yeah. Set yourself up to succeed. Yeah. Oh, I love that.
And the woman who shared, a therapist, I'm blanking on her name right now, but she's on, I think, 126 episode, and she talked about loving kindness, acts of loving kindness. There are some beautiful meditations on YouTube or Insight Timer or any app you have. Look up loving kindness meditations. Those really are lovely and are simple and can come with you wherever you are. If you're upset, it's in the middle of the night, you can listen to some of these meditations that just send loving kindness to yourself. I think of, I'm back to Glenda again. Sorry, Glenda. But you know how we love animals? Are these loving hands who love animals can also love us? And I do silent meditation and I put my hands on my chest and my belly and I don't even say anything. I just bring those hands that love animals. I know that sounds weird, but you guys, I'm recovering because I had some serious bad stuff done and not only said to me, but also done to me. And I have to reclaim love and not let it get lost because of cruel people or ignorant people, violent people. Like, I want to reclaim the life force and the loving kindness force. Yes. So it starts with me.
Yes, I love that. I love throughout this whole narrative how you have brought from within yourself, you know, the strength to push back against all of these negative things and find the way to get better and seek healing and recovery. And I think that is so amazing that you never let anyone keep you down for long. And right. that is so powerful. And I really have enjoyed hearing your tips as well. This is fantastic. And I wonder, before we are getting close to time to wrap up, but this is just so good. Do you have any other final comments or tips or anything that you want to share with us before we go to Q&A?
Gosh, I just want to thank you so much, Kara, for such an interesting conversation. And the gang, the
Jazz hands.
Stompers, the exec producer, the president who founded this organization, and volunteers that are signing up by the barrel. Yes. It's just so exciting. Really, it is. And think how many people you're helping. It's just
thank
wonderful.
You. Well, thank you so much. And we are so glad to have had you on. This has been a wonderful talk. And I hope everyone else got as much out of it as I did. But thank you for coming and for all of your work that you're doing too, helping people recover. Also, that is so important. And don't forget, everyone, there are plenty of resources. I know Jen has mentioned a few of her books. You've also got some other links and places where people can find you, right? Would you like to share any of those? And I can drop them in the chat.
Sure. I they're all on the thing I've sent you.
Got it. I will drop them in.
And embolden you, I can put that in the chat.
Okay.
.com is my website.
Got it. And I know we've got a couple of your books here as well. I'm going to drop those in too. Those are fantastic. I read the first one, Faith Born of Seduction, and I was fascinated. It's an academic book and it reads, you know, very almost narrative-like in a lot of parts.
Yeah. And I can, anyone that wants, I can give you one of those chapters because I sort of thought I was going to get it as a download. But I thought, why don't I just give it to people? Because I want to be a good Catholic woman. Joke. No, it's really more that I want I want it to be available. I guess I should just say I've written on this. I will give you a chapter of either of these books, because that sounds pretty reasonable, don't you think, Kara?
Well, absolutely. Yes. So get in touch if you want a chapter. Can they find a contact for you on your website on Embolden
sure
You?
Can. Yes.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Well, everybody go check it out then. And we have questions. Do you want to answer a few questions from the chat?
I wish they were in audio. That books aren't in audio, but I want to shout out that audio is my favorite, given how much I'm on screens, you know, and yes. I'm trying to do kind of a healthy curfew on screen time, but not deprive myself in any way. But Vincent writes about gratitude journal. I wanted to say that that's a really cool thing. Even if you're a curmudgeon, I like that. But what I find helps is to have it be more of an appreciation journal, so you can access your true heart of appreciation, and keep it simple. You know, it doesn't have to be, I mean, I genuinely appreciate that I can taste delicious food, and some people I know have a colostomy bag. You know what I mean? Like I can really access things I appreciate. I'm so grateful that I can heal from my trauma and have new relationships with family even. And I don't keep quiet, they know. But I also don't live in the harms, you know. I've done a lot of, here's my experience. I it's real for me. Whatever you see here I've done a lot of work to integrate both pain and hope, and I'm not going to pretend it's all jolly. So, and then when I hear horrible things, I definitely speak up at my family dinners. I definitely say, wow, you know, when their black and white thinking doesn't sound like love, I can bring up any tradition because I taught world traditions. So pretty much all the traditions have love your neighbor as yourself. And so we can always pull that one out if we hear hate spewing.
Oh, wait, Jesus didn't make that up?
No.
Oh, huh.
No. And even Confucius reworded it as, don't do unto others what they wouldn't do unto you. So I kind of like that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's calling you out. That's great. Great advice. Okay, well, let's go into some more of the questions too. And I collect the questions without the person's name who asked them, just in case there are people in the chat who aren't publicly out. Oh, you're fine. But just so I won't say their name when I ask the question, but you know, they'll know we're answering their question most likely. One of the questions that people asked is, speaking of books, can you recommend any other books for people who are affected by religious trauma? Obviously there's yours, but do you have any others?
Yes, anything by Marie Fortune, Fortun, and I can put that in there.
Okay. Yeah, that would be great. I'm actually interested in checking some of these resources out too.
Yeah,
Marie Fortune.
One of my most hopeful people is named Charlotte Davis Castle. I just love her.
Oh. Okay, so we have Marie Fortune and Charlotte Davis Castle.
Yeah,
okay.
Very hopeful Castle. And Marie Fortune is who I studied with before going to seminary. I have another friend at Harvard. We were writing at the same time, and I want to spell her name correctly, so I'm going to look it up. She wrote on trauma and religion as I did, and we both wrote on eating disorders. Both of us have been survivors of eating disorders. So I'm going to look her book title up while you keep talking.
Fair enough. I think Gail might have a question for you too.
Jennifer, thank you. This has been an incredible presentation on a personal level. My daughter Glenda and I have been behind the scenes chatting and cheering you on the entire way. You've done such a good job of articulating our experience as well. And so I'm going to take a point of privilege. This is not the next question in the line, and I hope we can get to all of them. But my question to you
is a personal one. How are you, how is your relationship with your family? Has that continued to stay fractured? Have you had any kind of reconciliation? How do you manage that now, all these years later?
I found the book. Sorry, I'm going to say yes. Yes, let's see. I have done so much work to, you know, I've done trauma treatment. I was hospitalized for a breakthrough. I call it a breakthrough, not a breakdown, for putting it all together. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't tease it apart because I was studying really great stuff as a critical thinker. And then I had this haunting going on too. And so how it emerged that I needed help was I couldn't sleep. And I think that's why I probably am so big on sleep. I couldn't sleep. I had a near rape. Someone tried to rape me. And because of being a good imitator of what I thought was Jesus, I said, "Oh, sir, I'm so sorry. It must be me. I am a Christian minister." And this wasn't true, by the way. I'm a Christian minister and I don't have sex before marriage. And he said, my dad was a minister and he's 6 feet under. And I was like, oh my God. Anyway, so that was the kick up of not sleeping for 8 days. And so I was taken to a hospital. So I don't want you to think I tried to kill myself. Not that that would be illogical. But no, it was, I couldn't sleep. And I was, you know how that is. I mean, it's scientific that you will not be able to make sense. Yeah, I was not able to function. And my friends took me there and I really didn't know where I was. I mean, it was very disturbing. But anyway, it did get me to go, I can't put these together. And I needed to tease them apart, but also accept that the rope, you know, or like yarn, you guys hear me talk about textile arts, that the carpet is woven called gen, and we tease out the toxic threads that are, you know, are unkind, cruel threads that haunt me, right? I've been teasing those out. Can't totally remove the effects because they are on the same cloth, but I've been pulling them out, looking at them, but also getting work, trauma treatment for those beliefs. I mean, they're toxic beliefs. So I'm just so grateful. Okay, some of them have to do with things that happened to me that someone looked away that I loved. That was the hardest. That was the worst. I know that's not fair for the perpetrator, but when folk that are in the area look away, oh, that's hard. And I used to call that secondary trauma, but it's not. It's trauma, capital T. And secondary trauma is what happens when you're a therapist and keep hearing these horrible things. And then you can't sleep because you have sort of a emerging kind of empathy that creates a co-PTSD. So I get help for that too. And I'm so glad that I am transparent, like I'm being with you. That's a piece of me getting empowered, and is not pretending I'm not one of us who's walking a path that has some kind of walking wounded element to it, you know? But I definitely see it as a Kickstarter for building allies and finding allies. And, you know, it opens my drawbridge to find safe places, right, to share and be connected with. I don't have to be locked up in a castle or in a vault of my prayer closet, you know. So I do see it as somewhat, you know, I use the word enlivening versus spiritual, but I see it as a kind of enlivening and helping others find their voice and tease apart what helps and what hinders their heritage. How is it helping? How is it hindering? And authorizing that we are authoring now. We didn't, as little ones, we didn't have a pen to author our lives, but we do as adults, we get to help share and co-create what's next for us. And so I do feel it can be very hopeful, but breaking the secrets, I think, is the beginning.
Thank you for that was an awfully intimate question, and I appreciate you sharing from your heart. That was a lovely sentiment. The next question in the list, and I don't know if you have these statistics, it's an interesting topic that we share here at Recovering from Religion as well. Someone was curious about what percentage of people in a transition faith crisis go from believing in religion to full-on atheism. Do you have those statistics, or is that something that you have studied?
That's a fascinating question. No, I do not have those. And I think it's hard to gauge that, you know, it's kind of like asking, you know, people who struggle with binge eating, what was it like after you started that? You know what I mean? It's like, well, you know, so we so dip in and out of those ideas. But if you mean, like, I have three that I've worked with in the 30 years of working with people who were suicidal because they left their faith, Mormon, and that they were excommunicated and cast into outer darkness. That is pretty intense in terms of building a life for what's next. So, you know, did they stay free from those beliefs? No. You know, did they go back? No, not the ones I've worked with.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me it's cyclical, it's somewhat fluid. And here at Recovering from Religion, that's one of the least important questions. How someone chooses to identify, the word that they use to identify, it matters not to me. We want to empower people to identify the way they want to identify. The process is far more important than the end result. The developing of critical skills, I love the illustration you used of teasing those toxic threads out, you know, doing that hard, heavy lifting, that emotional labor of processing that and bringing it back up again and trying to remember, you know, what was said and what was the context and who said it and who was there. Your point about not being defended by the people who should most defend you just struck at my heart. Anyway, I'm gotten a little far afield, but as people go through faith crisis, what we find at Recovering from Religion is there's no question that the description is it's a journey. It's not a destination. You don't go, here, got it all worked out. I've got it figured out. I've got it worked out. Even those of us who have been deconverted for a number of years and who are confident in our moral beliefs and our, you know, our standards and what we want to have as our legacy and all the things, there's always room to go, oh, now, wait a minute. Where did that come from? That just came back up again. Let me see if I can backtrack and find that. So that's a question too, that it's interesting topic of discussion, but it's not as important as the process itself. The end result is not. Kara, do we have another question?
Yes, we do. I think we have time for one more. And I will ask this one. Someone has asked, and this question actually comes up every now and then, so I'm happy to talk about it again and hear your perspective on it, Jen. They were wondering, what are some ways that we can find community? And this person in particular is saying they live in the South and it's hard to find groups that are skeptical or things like that. Do you have any advice for where people can find that kind of community?
Critical thinkers?
Yes, I think it's referring to critical thinking communities but possibly any kind of community that you think people might be able to find helpful as they're going through some of this work of healing.
You know, I also think starting a support group, you know, there are all kinds, I'm sure y'all, if you have any formal support groups, that there are certain templates that can be downloaded, I would think, to start your own if there's nothing in view. If you look at 12 Steps Agnostics, they have some really cool literature. Any 12 Step Agnostic stuff you could pull down their meeting format and make it your own. It doesn't have to be 12 steps, but I mean, just looking at how do they use cultivating clarity? How do they use finding, you know, a life that's not dependent on the harms that we've experienced? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how can we invent from here? And how can we keep, you know, keep ourselves in a well-rounded balance? And I love that about that organization. And it's not a formal one, as you know, but there are tons of spinoffs. There's also, what's those meetups?
Yes, meetup, yes.
You can advertise meetup.com or whatnot. You can create critical thinking groups from former religious conservatives or something, you know. Mm-hmm. You can say, I survived blah, blah, and I want to build a hopeful future. Because the thing is, what gets lost with tradition, besides the group, community, and order, structure, is the idea of hope. Mm-hmm. Because in most traditions, there's this idea, there's hope in some better future, hope in heaven, or hope in whatever, hope in salvation, or helping the next person become saved. There's all this stuff about a promising future. So again, once that's gone, it's pretty scary to have, well, what do I have hope for? And what is going to happen to me? I actually never think about what's going to happen to me after I die, except that it might nourish the soil. But, you know, in our day, we're probably not going to do that because of we don't want to be toxic in the planet any more than we already are. But no, I don't think about that. But some people do after leaving a tradition. Mm-hmm. Am I damned? Is outer darkness real? We need to think together, and they're all different people. I think the main thing, even in a meetup, is to make sure there's no one dominating, so that leadership needs to be rotating. Otherwise, you get personalities and that are new thinkers that you need to adjust to.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point too, is also thinking critically about the new groups and activities that we start doing. We definitely don't want to fall back into something that sounds different, but has similar characteristics to what we just got out of, sort of jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire. So thank you for bringing that up.
You were vulnerable, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. It'd be kind of squishy without the oyster of righteous. We're the right group, you know,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, like a hermit crab leaves its little shell because it needs a bigger venue, you know?
Yeah.
But during that middle period there, it's very vulnerable without a mm-hmm. shell. So that generosity of spirit with self and staying close to safe others,
mm-hmm.
you know, who need you too. And rather than you're under their wing. Because it just like with domestic violence, it's so important that the person be hearing their own voice and what do you think? And rather than here's what you need to do if you want to be free, mm-hmm. it's still more authority down and top mm-hmm. down freedom. So it's tricky. I mean, the main thing is good-heartedness, I think. Do you feel safe with that new friendship, that new group?
Mm-hmm. Great points. Well, thank you once again, Dr. Jen. This was amazing. So many good tips and pieces of advice. I just really cannot say enough how great that was. That was so helpful for me too to hear. So thank you for joining us. And again, thank you for all of your work that you do with, for example, the Secular Therapy Project and helping people heal.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, Healing, and Support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.